Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I'm so pleased to see you here despite that brilliant, wonderful, sunny weather we are having in Ithaca. Well, you'll get a chance to go back out and enjoy it after a very invigorating presentation this afternoon. Good afternoon, my name is Judith Byfield. My pronouns are she and her. I am a professor in the Department of History here at Cornell, and I write on women's social and economic history in Nigeria. Hence, I had actually already planned to come to this talk before I was asked to introduce and moderate our session this afternoon. I'm moderating this session on behalf of the Johnson Museum of Art and the Campus-Wide Migrations Global Grand Challenge. I welcome everyone to today's program from Cornell University, which sits on the traditional homelands of the Gayo-Kono, the Cayuga Nation. The Gayo-Kono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayo-Kono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gayo-Kono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. Today's discussion is supported by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation's Just Futures Initiative. Through this initiative, Cornell's Migrations Global Grand Challenge and the Mellon Foundation have established a partnership to support research and learning that bring a global focus to dispossession, racism, migration, and strategies for creating a just future. Our speaker today uses multiple forms of creative expression to meditate on and explore the topics at the core of this collaboration between Cornell and the Mellon Foundation. Precious Okoyoman, whose pronouns are they and their, is a Nigerian-American poet and artist living and working in Brooklyn, New York City. They use poetry, cooking, and sculpture to explore and practice building communities, to reflect on our relationship with nature, the individual and existential angst produced by our extractive economies, as well as the kaleidoscope of language, foods, music, and cultural practices that are the outcome of and witness to the multiple pathways of migrations that define our contemporary world. Regardless of the form and the medium, whether it's curated dinner parties with the collective Spiral Theory Test Kitchen, or a lush installation with plants that include kudzu and sugarcane and live butterflies, or a book of poetry, Okoyoman's work has stimulated interest and reflection. They have had institutional solo exhibits at the Luma Westbau in Zurich in 2018, the Museum für Moderne Kunst in Frankfurt 2020, and Performance Space in New York 2021, as well as the Aspen Art Museum also in 2021. They are included in the 59th Venice Biennial in 2022, the 58th Belgrade Biennial in 2021, as well as group exhibits at the Palais de Tokyo in Paris in 2021. Major performances have been commissioned by the Serpentine in London in 2019, as well as the Institute of Contemporary Art in London in 2019. Their second book of poetry, But Did You Die?, will be co-published by the Serpentine and Wonder Press in 2022. Okoyoman was also a 2020 artist in residence at the Luma Arles in France. In addition, Presence has received several important awards. They are the 2021 recipient of the Frieze Art Fair Artist Award and the 2022 Chanel Next Art Prize. And so it is indeed my great pleasure to introduce you to our speaker today, Precious Okoyomon.
Hi, everyone. I like to kind of start off by having us all be on the same type of vibrational page. So I'm going to just ask everyone to take a moment and close their eyes here and virtually. And we're all going to take a collective breath together and just like, you know, be in our bodies for the first time today. Right? Or maybe you were already in your body, but... Yeah, feel yourself slowly tethered to the earth. Remember, I am not this body, I am the universe constantly. It's nice to be here with you. I'm going to read you some poems. So I've been working on this book for forever. If anyone's a writer, you know how long it takes to let your words go and like be in the world. So this is my like 4-year, 5-year-old baby. She's coming out in a few months, actually, in October. So a few years ago, I started writing these poems called Sky Songs, and they're large influences on my installations and just how I think about the world, and they're kind of these prayers to the sky. Sky song. Give your body for abstraction, bite your tongue and eat it. This is a corrective therapy. Now into one alienated. Now into the meat of the world. Don't speak to me in obscurities, recreations, stripped down, carry nothing but light, only light. No longer clutch to guaranteed space, but recreate space, temporalize space, the universe as adapting space, a love that gives space, a love that is space, tactile, palatial, and self-immolating. Become the room, let the silence undo you. Now release into the morning light. Life rubs up against matter, inner core against inner core. Try not to be afraid. You don't have to be afraid. Now in your own loving words, no to the fragility of language, no to the ego, no to the colonial context of thought, no to fake tenderness, no to liberation without destruction, no to self-destruction, no to masters. The light washes the body clean, lay throbbing in the sky to live affixed to the circuitry of the world. The body is pinned to the sky in blue, reborn in this energy, caught and released, lucid, intangible realities of dust. The sky sweeps it all away, regulate the unconscious play of the mind. Have you ever seen pink moonlight? It's frightening. And this is a sky song I wrote for my friend Fred. Somewhere I read you long to dispossess yourself of yourself, slowly adjust to the suffering in this shit again. The other day, watching the sky drowning in blue, I laid in the grass and I shouted a Dumas poem to the sun. Take the blood up from the grass, sun, take it up. These people do not thirst for it. Take up the insect children that play in the grass, sun. Take them away. These people are sick of them. Take down the long, slender reeds, sun. Cut them down. These people cannot make flutes any longer. Now, sun, come closer to the earth, even closer than that. Closer now, sun. Take away the shape from the metal, sun. They're like stone, these people. Now, make them lava. I like there to be a space for destruction. a new space-time, a crushed-down pounding suspension of a storm of articulation. I mean, no, but yes, but no. Motherfuckers are always asking me too many questions. Dispossession of that individuality held in that unconscious that never given itself away. What if it's not about putting shit together, but how shit falls apart? Shit. Open that void wide up. Open up, get in, lick it up. It's the rationality of the decolonization, the brutalizing interplay of that centrality and constrained motion. Reform, fade up, a dark empty room lit by only evening light, a window set high up against a black wall, no color, no percussion, footsteps the only sound. Don't cry, baby. Dry your pretty eyes and smile at me. It's space-time itself. Ever since I woke up this morning, I've had so many horrible thoughts. I thought about people on who I agree on 99% of what they say and who I share 99% of their desires. I've lost count. That's bad. I really want to work on that. I really want to work on being a better person, but I can't do it in my head or in the interpersonal diorama. It's inside, it's outside, it's non-externalizable, a war of our own correlative images. We comically fall off a cliff, wash into view. Now come into everyday life, now double that into open outer space, the performative enactment of our always already being, singing Hosanna in the ear of anarchist bliss, furiously falling into love. Mysterious, mischievous end, always love. The other day, lying in the green, watching the everyday sky go from pitch to dim to violet to pink, it settles. Yeah, so I've been writing these prayers to the sky, and they really, yeah. And they really like influence everything I've been kind of doing, because I see everything as this kind of endless poem. I kind of started making art through poetry as like a ritual practice of trying to track my everyday memory into shared co-emergence, copiosis of like my friends asking me to play with them, really. I'm gonna go through, I made like a slideshow of my work. Some of the first things I ever did are really actually with my friends. This first show I did with my friend a really long time ago called I Need Help. My friend Hannah Black really needed help. And she asked me to make a show with her. Because sometimes artists can't do things by themselves, and we usually don't. That's what I'm always trying to remind people, that is like nobody's ever doing anything by themselves, even if they say they are. Nobody is a single being. We're all just playing with each other. So this is a co-made piece from me and Hannah of raw lamb's wool, which appears over and over, and it's a motif in my work that when I was a child, my grandmother would make me these indestructible dolls of lamb's wool, because I had this horrible habit of destroying all my toys. So she would make me toys that even if I destroyed them, they could be put back together. So it's always been this like return of this like undestroyable factor. This is made of raw lamb's wool and clay. It's the snake that continuously eats itself. And this is kind of the press release. And these are the smaller versions of the raw lamb's wool dolls that I've made. And Hannah wrote this lovely book called The Situation, which I honestly advise everyone to find on it. If you find my email after this, or find me and I'll ask me for my email, I have a PDF of this book. Hannah is one of my favorite living artists and writers, and she actually just released a new poetry book that everyone should get. Hannah Black, genius, actual living genius. And this book called The Situation, where she would interview people about their different situations, and she removed their names, and the whole book just became about this situation as the object. And then she shredded down the book and we threw the shreds everywhere. She had to show it the Chisenhale, and then all the shreds came and I mixed them with my wool and my dirt and the original nature memory. And together we made the show of fragmented help love. And this is the result of that. A lot of stuffed teddy bears dripping out, shreds of books, a lot of raw wool dolls, leaking bears. Cuteness is its own violence. This is a show I did with one of my best friends, Quinn Haroldson, at his project space in Miami, called Making Me Blush. Again, another collaboration with one of my dear friends, Jade Puppies and Puppies, also an amazing artist. If you don't know their work, it's really like weird conceptual stuff. They took lamb hearts and they shoved arrows through them. And if you look, that's what's like on the floor over there. You can see like a lamb heart with a with an arrow shoved through it. It was quite beautiful, and it would like the blood would leak upon the floor and these kind of voting booths. And then in the back was one of my first lynching trees, which are fruiting fig trees with these angels I make on them, the always already motif of like, how could you kill an angel? It lives forever, which I constantly see as like this libidinal black life that you can never destroy, because I mean, it is the quantum thing that moves the earth. Can't really destroy dark matter. I can barely figure it out. So my lynching trees are always this like ever expression of life, and the best thing is that you can secretly eat fruit off of them if you're in the gallery at the right time. And my lovely little bears, I had this bird that just flew through the gallery wildly at all times and would find itself perched in the tree. My little angel protector. And from there, it kind of moved to my first solo show at Luma Westbau, which I made a forest of lynching trees, and it rained a cotton snow as you walked through the galleries. And it was actually a really special space because it's inside of, it's a black room, unusually as the white cubes were in. And it would rain the snow every day and my lynching trees. And as the installation started, the trees were barren. As slowly as it went on, you were able to like pick the fruit off the trees and like slowly watch them. Because in this forced environment of growth, they're forced to bloom, which I always think is kind of special. And surprisingly, mushrooms popped up in here in their own little contained space. I'm always surprised about the miracles that occur in my art that I never really plan. Surprise and chaos are my two favorite things. I made these lanterns based on the 18th century lantern laws of like raw black lamb's wool, which constantly I'm in love with the suffering black lamb. I made one, and then in the back of my little forest, I made this video with my, I made this video with my little brother where, me and him together kind of came up with, he would always confess things to me whenever I was home, and I'd be like, wow, why didn't you tell me about that ever before? So he would like, would sit in his car and he would like tell me this really intense story, and I'd be like, wow, you've been holding this in forever. So we kind of like have this relationship where he'll like be like, I have to tell you something, and like he'll bring me into his car because he's like such a car boy, and then he'll like confess something deep and dark to me. So I was like, whoa, I guess I should start recording this or something, like how can I help? So for years he had been having these like really intense like encounters with the cops from like, and he like tells them in this like really casual way where he's like, that was crazy. So I started recording all of these and made this video of a little bear walking through the woods smoking a blunt. And it's like, let's see if I can make this work on both. I'm going to figure this out. Bear with me. For some reason, it doesn't want to play on the same screen. Okay. Technology. Okay, let's see. Yeah, it's, let's see. Wow, help. Thank you, okay. All right, here's the video.
Here, huh?
We're so lucky.
So I remember this one time I was just chilling, hanging out with my friend Spencer. And we were chilling, smoking weed, rolling backwards and whatnot. And all of a sudden we just got the munchies. So we was just like, alright, we'll go get some chicken wings. We'll go get some chicken wings and shit. So, boom. We roll up two woods for the way there. And we hop in my Mercedes that we've been hotboxing earlier, reeks of weed. So we start heading towards the wing store, the wing restaurant. They try to take the soul out of me. They try to take my confidence, and they know I'm cocky. Fuck another interview, I'm done with it. And we're, you know, chilling, smoking, listening to music and whatnot, jamming. And we're halfway there, and all of a sudden a cop pulls behind us. Make me a pop star, and they made a monster. I'm posted with my niggas in the champagne floor. A nigga was depressed, now my mind. So we freaking just panicked. Try to cut the roaches in the mass trays. Cause we had a bunch of lead on us. So I just think fast and I tell him to hand me all the lead. And I just tuck it under the back seat. Boom. We pull over. And when we pull over, we're in the middle of a bridge. I'm in front of everyone. This remind me when I had nightmares. So the cop walks up to the car, we roll the window down, and smoke just pours out the window. Instead of told you I was gonna lap, nigga. So the cop immediately asked, where's the weed? Words can't breathe. They sent the ghetto bird out to pick me. They finally did admit it, I was blown. Because I wasn't bitch. We told him we had already smoked and that we didn't have any more weed on us, but I just want the money, he wasn't trying to hear that. And he had walked up to the car with his hand on his gun, so we had our hand on the wheel and we were just trying not to get shot. That shit was so fucked up, man. So the cop just orders us each out of the car after calling for backup. They search us, make us take our shoes off and socks, and pat us down to see what we have. And we don't have anything on us. So they start searching the car from top to bottom, looking at every crevice, the glove box, the trunk, the spare tire, and they don't find any weed. Then all of a sudden, another cop goes back up to the car, looks in the ashtray, and pulls out a roach. So they send me back to the car, telling me I'm lucky that they know we were drug dealers and that they were gonna catch us. So they sent me back to the car, wrote my friend a weed ticket, and took his picture, and then sent him back to the car. That shit was so fucked up. I try to forget about that night all the time.
Yeah, so I'm always making work. A lot of my work is with my family and my friends, constantly like unpacking like family trauma. Thank you. No, I love help. I love it.
Okay.
Amazing.
And we run the video, which is like, bam.
Bam. Wow. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, so a lot of the work is always like unpacking family trauma, dealing with like interpersonal relationships, thinking about like this everyday like confession of like, so for me, working with my brother, in the last like few years, we've been making a lot of like videos together, a lot of like really like these confessions he makes to me, and I've like archived them all. I think of it as like relational like aesthetics therapy. It's like really beautiful for us in a way that he doesn't have a lot of people. I think with like masculinity, it's hard to like confess a lot of your like inner things with people. So it's like really working like to unpack this like kind of generational stuff too, that I think of like as a practice of like literal everyday things that I do. And this work is really special to me because I made this right before COVID, actually. I made this in Germany. It's after Octavia Butler's Earth Seeds. And I installed this maybe 3 months before COVID. And nobody saw it for 6 months, which was really special. It was a room of invasives for itself. Like three people went in here, the museum director and like the people who watered it. And I would just watch the videos because they had a live stream. That was my only kind of like relation to it. I was like, that's crazy. This kind of portal I made is just there in Germany happening while the world is slowly like unfurling and like crumbling. And this was just steadily growing there. It's a space of kudzu, which is a plant that I work with a lot. We have a very entangled relationship. It has a very special history. It was brought to the U.S. after slavery because of the kind of wild spread like soil erosion that had happened from the overplanting of cotton. And the US government was like, what if we gave these kudzu seeds to farmers to help them and it will magically solve soil erosion? Obviously that's not how things work. The kudzu like completely like ate all these plantations and all of these farms, and it's quite beautiful because even today when you drive through the South, you see these like giant kudzu trees that just enwrap and ensnarl everything. It's like, I think it's really special. I always say where you see, I feel the most racism in the U.S. and this is always the kudzu leaking there. Like, you know, and it's so in like beautifully intrinsic because the roots are like kind of what hold the South together. And if you were to take away the kudzu, the soil would kind of crumble, which is a very beautiful metaphor for like where we see ourselves today. So I like making these spaces for like, I call them portals that are where things can thrive without, you know, any interference. And things get pretty wild in there, and I truly never know what's going to happen. In this installation, we had like kind of like snail problem. They just all appeared, and like there were like random moths that would fly through the windows and make like little nests, and there was a mushroom. Mushrooms are always appearing for me. They're root connectivities, and this is, you know, about like 4 months in. And I never really trim back, so things really do disappear, and the ecosystem keeps building itself. And since I work with a lot of invasive plants, we can't really replant after, so everything usually gets burned, and then I make work with the ash. It's all a continuous ecosystem from like the thing before has its lineage, and then it continues. I never really see it as ending, but evolving. The death, the decay, the life, it's all part of the next thing or what's leaking into the other thing. And these are the raw wool dolls that started off as the tiny dolls. And then after I burned all of that kudzu, this kudzu, I turned it into ash. And I made this really special show called Fragmented Body Perceptions as Higher Vibration Frequencies to God, which started off as a poem. And then I felt that it actually needed to be a space. And I was asked to make this show at Performance Space New York, which is actually a really amazing space. And if you're ever in New York, you should go there because I think it's one of the most special kind of museum spaces that people don't know about. And this fall, they're actually doing a lot of workshops about body movement and care. Yeah, I shout out Performance Space a lot. I'm like, go! and I made this special room to hold people, really, whatever emotion they wanted to process from the immense grief that I felt that was like in the air after COVID. I mean, just like, you know, the immense loss that everyone had just experienced, and like, where do you put all that pain? How do you hold it? How do you allow yourself the space to break down? What are the spaces you can do that in? So I made a space to just go. And it was interesting to see what people did there. I heard a lot of rumors. I would walk in all the time just to check on my little world, and I would see people crying, like kids just like playing, people holding each other. I like to say I just make the portals for the breakdown to happen in any way it occurs. And then it rained the ash in here from the kudzu. It was kind of nice because you really couldn't breathe it in and you had your mask. And if you tried to, you'd end up like coughing. It was like this ash mist from bubbles. It was like this bubble ash, which is kind of nice because you actually expect it to be rather heavy, but it's like this light mist. And I had ladybugs in here and a slow garden. I just planted wildflowers, and what grew surprised me inside of the thick clay. had a little waterfall. It was just a nice space to have people go and like be there. Some people like really took this as a grieving space. Some people were like, oh, I don't know what people are talking about. I had a great date in there. And I was like, wow. So I always say it's like whatever I can give people and what they take from it is all I can hope that there was just some love in there. And for the last 2 years, kind of after this project, I started this garden, which I'd never really made an outdoor work. It started from this poem, preserve sound into accelerationist light, explosions into the black inferno, the last futures we would all become, the portal into the quadraphonic playground of exploding hearts of new errant roots. So I wrote this poem a really long time ago and I had no idea where it was in the world. I just knew it was a place and I wanted to make this kind of root system playground of dreaming. And then someone was like, do you want to make a garden? And I was like, yeah, I think this is my quadraphonic playground. And for the last 2 years, I've been playing on the Aspen Rooftop Museum. I made a really crazy invasive garden of wild indigenous wildflowers and invasive plants. And every season I made a sculpture to protect my garden. The first one was a black angel named Ditto Ditto, with her heart is made of lamb's blood and concrete. A lot of my images are like, you know, going back to a, like, I grew up extremely like Christian and like a really Christian household, and like both of my parents are like, my mom is like Ishan and my dad's Yoruba, so both bringing like that influence of like extremely religious Nigerian backgrounds into this kind of work of like ritual and meditation. It's been nice to kind of create the figures I want to see that don't exist of protection. They're always usually like figures of like black women, non-human bodies, little ghost. I love a little ghost. It was really special to make space for all of these flowers that had, that would have thrived otherwise in Aspen if they like had space to do so, and people wanted them. Usually it's a lot of things that people see as like weeds and not usually like super ornamental, like beautiful flowers. And it was interesting to have this space of like cultivated like lushness in a way that wasn't an organized garden in the way you would expect. And my friend Gio, who's a great collaborator with me, he helps me kind of make all my music. He is an amazing jazz musician. He has a band called Standing on the Corner, which they are just like, I say time travelers, like futuristic time travelers. Like his music is so beautiful and special. And it's just been really interesting to like collaborate and play with somebody who is coming from a different like sound space. Like I think poetry is like music constantly because it's like finding the language to like anchor and play and like love and play, and then music comes in and is like the wind for me. So it's been wonderful working with somebody who I feel like is a wind maker. And he made all the music for the last two seasons. And I made a ceramic sculpture. It was the first time working with ceramics, which was super exciting for me. So a lot of the last few years have been like kind of like learning and playing in public of like figuring out what I want to make and like just kind of making it. And like playing, really, play is such a big part for me because it's like I honestly never am like, this is what I know I want to make. It's always like, oh, actually, what am I like hungry for, and where do I want to like dip my toes in? And then I'm like stumbled into a sculpture, and I'm like, oh, am I working with like ceramics or concrete? It's all about a malleability for me. I'm always trying to tell people like to escape the rigidity of like expectation of yourself, of knowing. There's a real freedom to a non-knowing. I got to make this really special treehouse of fragilization because I think about a lot with like soil and migration and plants, like how we can find little like safety spots. So for me, I created this womb where you entered, and then after you like brushed past this like door of stuffed animals. You entered this womb where my poems were just being read to you in a loop for like 2 hours, and you just sit in there. It's like you're in a world of your own. It was kind of cute because last time I was in Aspen, I walked in there and it was just like these three little girls like by themselves in the middle of the treehouse, just like listening to my poems, like looking at the sky. I was like, I'm obsessed. And this is my little figure. And my latest project that I did was Venice, the Venice Biennale, which was really special because then my relationship again with Kudzu, and now this new plant, sugarcane, which I also have like an intrinsic history with, and a lot of, once again, like migration and the history of like how you really can't separate, like you can't separate the object from its history. It's like impossible. So you the memory, also the soil memory, the plant memory, these things don't forget, we don't forget. I just try and hold space for that memory to come and teach us something new. So I made this crazy forest in the middle of the biennial. And it's slowly been growing for the last like 6 months, and it's been really interesting to me because I haven't been there back since it opened, and it's like updated daily. Like I get pictures on Instagram and people are like, look, I can't see your exhibition anymore. And it's kind of like a joy to me. I'm like, oh yeah, it's disappeared. So the expectation of like the surprise for me. And these are also made of raw lamb's wool. We poured these like concrete floors, and there's a black algae waterfall going through the whole space. So as you walk through, and Gio, who I work with closely, made the music, and it kind of sounds like this alarm of wind. If any of you go to Venice, send me some pictures. It's and there are butterflies flying all around, and I've kind of inverted night and day. So when people are in it, it's technically their nighttime, so they don't fly. But then they only fly for themselves at night when no one's there, which I think is kind of lovely. They're just doing their orchestrated dance just for them. And sometimes you see a butterfly if you're lucky. In the darkness. The sugarcane and the kudzu are kind of like competing at the moment for who will survive inside of the garden of pleasure. Yeah, that's kind of it. I wanted to open up to see if anyone had questions or like just generally wanted to like talk about stuff. I'm here to pollinate with you. No, so usually with the kudzu, it's one of those plants that's hard to grow from seed. So I work with local landscapers and farmers, and since I had made the show in Europe before, I worked with the same people who had cultivated my kudzu the last time, because it's really illegal to grow in the U.S. So when I do have it in shows in the U.S., I work. There's this really lovely lady in North Carolina in Asheville who is doing really important work going around and kind of sending people, like spreading information about like how do we actually like healthily entangle with kudzu in the South, especially like how to seed save with it, like how to make medicine. So she sends me all my US kudzu cuttings. Shh, don't tell the government, but I'm not growing kudzu in the US, definitely, you know. But yeah, usually not from seeds at all. It's it's one of my favorite plants like in the world. It's a very special plant with a really complicated history. Yeah. Yes.
Where did you first encounter kudzu, one? And two, I love that you...
Where did you first encounter kudzu yourself? And I love that you, when you're done using it, that, yes, you have to burn it, but then that you take the ash and transform into something else. So could you talk a little about that process?
When I was 15, my parents had this obsession with going to oracles, and we went to see an oracle in Georgia, a Nigerian oracle who was there to, like, give us family advice. And we were in this very, like, it was very hot, and we were in this parking lot, and it was swallowed in kudzu. And I was like, what is this plant? And this man was like, oh, it's this demon plant. I was like, demon plant? What? My 15-year-old mind was blown, and I, like, went, like, furiously Googling, like, demonic vine. And that's, like, you know, what started this hunger for me. So it's always been, like, a really intense relationship I've had with, like, plants that are viewed as, like, monstrous or, like, you know, that have this kind of, like, connotation of being invasive. Because what does it mean to be invasive other than to thrive really well? And people not knowing how to be around that, working with it. It's, like, learning how to, like, really entangle in this unsure way. And for me, the life and death of it is really important too. So that's where the ash comes in, because it's like, you know, how do I work with this thing that, you know, I can't put back into a place where it's not from, you know? So it's like I have to kill it, but not in this way that it's dead forever, because the ash travels into a lot of works. It was in the performance-based show, and then it's also in my Venice show in the water. It's like these little sprinkling, like, it's part of the poem, the notes from the poem that never end, that's continuously, like, flowing from one work to the next one. It's like a lineage, a love lineage, really. Yeah. Thanks for that question. I liked it.
A very ancient quality to them. I can't explain it, and I'm trying to think where, what they remind me of. Almost like Easter Island, things along those lines.
Yeah, they're deities of protection. They kind of have these, like, non-gendered bodies of, like, are they, what are they, you know? But they are, for me, they're these, like, soft protector figures and, like, also power figures of, like, they seem like something that would have been in the past, but they're also the future. You know, as I say, like, past can't help but be the future. So it's, you know, how do you see the thing that you have already known? It's a feel knowing for me of, like, thinking about these matrixial figures of protection that always follow my work. Yeah.
You seem to have very, you're deeply connected to the past, the present, and the future, very much how we see.
Time spiral, that's what I say. It's a deep time spiral, you know, it's like, for me, I'm always trying to, like, constantly analyze this deep connection I have with time, of understanding how to move through it in this way that I'm not repeating the constant mistakes of the human, in this way of, like, I'm always trying to, like, refigure how we get ourselves out of this little sticky mess that we're in of of, like, you know, the human can only reproduce what's come before it, and that's not of, it's of no interest to me. I'm constantly looking for new ways to evolve and think of, like, how we're a bit more malleable to, like, make new time for ourselves, time outside of time. Yeah. That's how we make a new future world. Collectively dreaming time outside of time.
One of the things that you said that I think really is mind-blowing or really resonating is to kind of that a type of freedom is to escape the rigidity of the expectation of knowing. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit more. I mean, certainly you delight in like the unexpectedness of the evolution of your works, but I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about how you see that philosophy playing out in your work and more generally in life, and how you see that part of what we could be open to if we didn't expect to know.
That's like a huge part of my everyday practice, or praxis, is like the really understanding of like, because I feel like, you know, we're all constant, there's like the neurosomatics of like our everyday wired motion helps us understand how we like truly witness or communicate with everyone. So we're already like semantically synced to be like, oh, we're supposed to think this one way and like know, have a knowing knowledge the world is supposed to give us. And I'm constantly like, I want to be broken every day by like opening wide. Like, and that type of vulnerability is very hard to go around in this world that's constantly trying to tell you that you're an individual and that there's nobody touching and changing you constantly. So my thing is like, how do you stay open and witness and being actually present in that practice to like allow yourself to be open? Because it's very hard to be fragile in this world. And I'm always trying to help people re-soften. And it's a hard thing. It's a real, like, you know, once you get over the primordial fear of the world every day when you wake up, and then the anxiety of the world, and then just remembering that, like, damn, this world is really moving, and how do I be in it, and also not being the world, but being here with other people, like, grounded in the earth. And then how do I just also see people? That's my thing. Hugest thing is, like, I love art, but also I love people more than I love art, and I love really seeing people and like communicating with them and like witnessing, and I feel like that actually teaches me a lot constantly, like the ability to like have real conversations where people show me and change me and shift me, and that allows for me to be able to come up with new languages, new ways of continuously softening, and that resistance, that everyday resistance to the constant consent to not being a single being is what everything is about for me. Yeah. It's hard work. But it's work that I'm like, we can't do it alone. It takes like, you know, that's the copiosis of like being with other people, truly. It's like work. Yeah.
Can you tell us about being a chef? And if you have a restaurant in Brooklyn, I'll come to it.
I don't have a restaurant, but come over and I'll cook for you. Me and my friends for the last few years have a collective called Spiral Theory Test Kitchen, where we feed people in like kind of like endless perverse ways. It's all about like feeding, play, and like I always think one of the best ways to change people is by like entering their bodies and feeding them, because it changes their microorgans, like tiny little parts, and then you're changed forever. You know, and I love that type of care work. It's like nurturing. It's like, what's the best way to say you love you? It's like, let me like nurture you and like witness and feed you. It's like a big part of like my love language is actually like nurturing and care. So food was one of those like miracle ways of doing that and getting people, gathering people and like feeding and like just having these chaotic, crazy meals, which we haven't been able to do in a while because of COVID, but I'm planning on doing some like soup kitchen meals this fall. So if you are in the city, like once again, find me after this, get my email. I will put you on my like food list and like come to Brooklyn. We'll have a little food fest.
Thank you so much for bringing us into your world here. There's just so much generosity in the work that's so stunning, and in your words too. But I'm struck too by, you made a couple of references to what happens when there are no people in the spaces, but it's butterflies. Or do you design for the time when there is no human audience, or is this a happy accident?
a non-human is always doing their thing. It's just, we're not always present for the communication that's happening. You know, how could I not when the work is like usually for itself? We just happen to be able to witness it. I truly am like making this for the plants. And they are doing their own root work. I wish I could listen in on their conversations. They're having fun in there. They're like, woo, we are like dueling. There's butterflies. There's like microorganisms doing their own thing. I never know. When I make a portal like this, I am completely surprised. Even the garden, I was like, how did these voles get in here on a rooftop? Like, you know, it's just like, that communication is like so, like the butterflies that only fly from themselves, the person who kind of like goes in and waters and organizes everything, he sends me these videos. I'll show you on my phone if you come to me, I'll show you on WhatsApp. They fly to like the music at night, like just for themselves. And that's like not for me to see or you, that's just them doing their own thing and their like miraculous pattern. So I'm just like cultivating and hoping that the miracles happen themselves, really.
Hi, my name is Mariah. It's wonderful to hear from you. It's actually, I've never seen anything like this before in my life. I've read poetry, but not like this, and I appreciate that. First, as a comment, I think the relationship you've got with your brother and sort of the talks you have with him, it's so reminiscent of, you know, sort of what I feel towards family and towards my relationship with my brother. We are in different places now, different countries, and we talk over the phone a lot, and he shares things with me, and sometimes he says, could you record this because I forget? Or he wants me to remember it for him, which is it. But what I wanted to ask you was, you referenced the word play a lot, and I can't say I've played since I was very little. I do work, and there's labor involved, and there's structures and timelines and schedules. How do you conceive of this word play as somebody who, you know, in your position? Because I don't know what it really means to play anymore as an adult. So tell me about that.
So constantly I feel like we're living, I have a lot of my focus is on like love. And when I think of love, I think of like how a lot of our love is coerced into labor of work, and how to escape that. And I think the loophole out of that is finding ourselves and grabbing onto each other and hoping that we can play together. And I mean that in the softest everyday ways. It's like, how do you find time for yourself to free yourself and other people? And I'm like in the littlest of ways. So like playing can literally be like, you hum yourself a tiny song every morning when you wake up and you go outside and you write yourself a poem, not even a big poem, something little, just to tether yourself back to the motion of the world. And that's a little play. So it's like finding little things that you don't remember how to give yourself freedom. My thing is I love rolling down hills, which sounds crazy, but I tell you guys, it's good, try it. I've done it a few times this week in Cornell's. Your hills are big. Oh my gosh, a dream, you know? Ooh. You know, you roll a bit, you let the equilibrium of the world shake you up, and then you get back up. Nothing can break you down for the rest of the day. It's like finding your way to get a little loose and malleable. And I think that, and that's the freedom that allows you to like, you know, fall back into the like rhythm of like yourself. And then you can be like, okay, I'm not just here by myself. Like, who else needs a little play today? And gets a bit infective, and then that's how you pollinate. The pollination play fantasy. Yeah, I'm all about shared play.
I don't own a cell phone. Put it and just be, and go read children's poems, and just laugh, and take the leaves and throw them up, and just let them cover you.
Yeah.
Put your rubber boots on and go splash in the puddles, or better yet, just splash in the puddles with no shoes.
I love that. Which is like so sometimes hard to do in our rigid ways if you're like, I don't want to get messy, you know? You're like, I have to go to work in a few hours. If it's like finding that like adaptation to allow yourself a little space, which, you know, once you get space, you can find some time, and then you figure out your rituals. And then from there, it gets a little easier because you're like, oh, this is what I need to survive, but then not survive. Oh, this is like a everyday thing that should happen because I shouldn't just be surviving or working. I should be finding a way to make my life a beautiful, like, rainstorm of a poem. You know, so it's like, what are your rituals that keep you, like, loose, malleable, and free? That's a good thing to figure out. And then from there, you know how to play because it's about, like, softening to figure out because everyone's play is different, you know? It's just like, how do you figure out what your rhythm is?
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Good.
Wait, congratulations. This is great work. I have a question about the idea of invasiveness. That, mm-hmm. You know, like, have you thought about this in relation to other aspects of other organisms? It really strike me the analogy of invasiveness, not like this. Katsu was brought, right, mm-hmm. for a purpose, mm-hmm. and then now it's being judged, right, as this exactly. kind of like competing organism, mm-hmm. right? And it,
yeah.
I mean, as for me, it's a very, it relates a lot to this. I mean, you know, I don't even have to tell you what it yeah. is, right? But we know, like, the judgment about, like, oh, now you're invasive, right? Like,
yeah.
as humans. Have you thought about this?
Yeah, I mean, it's like in the work of the idea of, like, migration, when you think about slavery, and also, like, kudzu, how it literally is, like, you've brought over this plant, and also you think about the abduction of, like, you know, like, literal, like, enslaved people in the U.S. and the idea of, like, to magically fix this, like, and build this land, literally build this land with blood time. It's like how also the soil does not forget, the history does not forget, like, those things don't disappear is what I'm constantly always saying, and it, like, it exists very much, like, in our soil life, in our plant life, like, they're holding these memories for us, even if, like, we don't hold the space to, like, the natural world is literally showing us our world just literally reflected in fragments. So I'm like, yeah, obviously, continuously thinking about how that's echoing into everything, always. Yeah.
I think we have time for one more question.
Okay, so my question is pretty simple, but you said that Hannah is your favorite living artist. Who is your favorite artist that's no longer here?
This is hard. I have a few. Can I give you like a rundown?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. I love Cecilia Vicuña. If you don't know the work, it's really beautiful, like, powerful, raw work of just endless, like, love, ritual, passion, thinking about the earth. So Cecilia Vicuña, a Telid non, like, rest in peace, she just died. Like, I'm so blessed to have her as an ancestor now, but also so sad she's not here. One of my favorite poets, like, hands down, I say, just started her poems and just deep dive down into her art, her videos, just, I mean, she's a genius. I love Fishley and Weiss. Also two of my favorite sculptors, like, one of them is no longer here with us, but also just a beautiful space to, like, look into that work if you haven't. And I mean, I'm a poet at heart, and I love Jack Spicer, so I'm going to throw out a Jack Spicer poetry, because I'm like, poetry and art, they're the same. I'm tired of fighting the battle. yeah, that's my rundown.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.